Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, December 15th, and it is living up to its reputation of being a snowy, wintry day. I'm glad to see everyone made it in one piece, and it seems maybe the forecasters overpredicted snowfall amounts. Keeping my fingers crossed. Anyway, the first matter on our calendar today is the matter of the civil commitment of Malcolm Renfro. I know you are both familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your argument, followed by 5 minutes rebuttal for appellant's counsel if you feel you need it. We are familiar with the briefs and the arguments, and when you are ready to proceed, you may do so.
Okay.
Oh, I should tell you, you're supposed to say your name and identify the party you represent, but you probably know.
Okay. So I would like to save the 5 minutes for rebuttal. And my name is Mary Hewitt. I represent the appellant here, Malcolm Renfro. Mr. Renfro, the appellant, was a 17-year-old young man when he was first sent to prison. He has been in prison for 10 years. He is now at the maximum secure facility at Moose Lake since June 6th of this year. The appellant, when he was arrested, was 17 years old, in high school, and was a star in the basketball team. He was a young 17-year-old, according to the transcript. His mother called him a baby when he was arrested. He was given a very severe sentence. He was sentenced to 144 months, and he is on a lifetime supervision through the Department of Corrections. And that is one of our arguments. We presented at the trial a less restrictive alternative, 253BD07 subdivision 3 allows for the respondent, or in this case, the appellant, to present clear and convincing evidence that a less restrictive alternative is available in the community.
And willing to take them. And I thought that the caseworker testified that there were no programs, treatment programs, in the community that were willing to take your client.
The examiners who do not find the treatments testified that they felt there were no appropriate treatments in the community. But the probation officer, or the intensive supervised release agent, Dawn Block, testified at the trial. And she testified that Mr. Renfro will be under the most severe Department of Corrections supervision. It is the most restrictive form of supervision that they have. And that supervision is used for all the high-risk offenders.
That's not treatment. Right. I mean, that's different from a sex offender treatment program in the community,
that is,
isn't it?
I was just bringing that up because it goes to the issue of public safety. But she did testify that there are sex offender programs available. And what she does is she tries to meet the needs of the offender by looking, she works together with them in the community to find a program. That is really her testimony.
It's going to be hard to find a program, isn't it? Because your client denies that he did anything wrong, which was the issue for him getting treatment when he was incarcerated.
That is correct. He denied that he had a culpability in the... He denied that the women were victims, I guess you would say. He said he had rough sex with them, and he knew he had done something. He wants to understand why. He did say that in the transcript. He wants to understand why, what he did wrong there. And he is willing to go to treatment. And so Ms. Block would be able to find a treatment that may address those issues. But the other factor here is there is a treatment program. It's a unique treatment program. It's called Transformation Ministries that is run by Pastor Mary Milton, who testified at the trial. And that program is set up specifically for Black men. And they have similar issues. She knows his history. She's willing to work with him. And she, according to her testimony, has had good response with people in the community that have similar problems.
Is and she, by training or experience, qualified to provide sex offender treatment, as that is more commonly understood?
Well, there's different types of treatment that a person can get for sex offending. She looks at transformation from the inside. That's what she stated in her testimony, that her treatment is about transformation. Well, sex offender treatment is about transformation. It's about changing from within. And this is specific to the Black man. And she knows the client. She knows Mr. Renfro, the appellant. And she is willing to work with him. And she's willing to work with him till some change is sustained. Now, this is beyond what Don Black, the ISR agent, is going to provide for him. And he is mandated to complete sex offender program. In the addendum I attached, it was Exhibit 101, it's Addendum 32. It has all the conditions of his release. He has very stringent conditions for his release. He has to complete sex offender treatment. He cannot drink. He cannot be around.
Well, that's an issue since he's making hooch in prison.
I'm sorry.
You said he can't drink as one of his conditions. I said that's an issue because he's making hooch in prison when he's in CD treatment in prison.
Well, he did admit that he did make the hooch in prison, but that's not a sex offense. I mean, that goes to his poor judgment, perhaps. But he said he wasn't going to drink anymore. And I can't raise that issue.
I just want to make sure I understand your brief.
Okay.
Because you addressed only the SPP provisions in your legal argument.
Yeah.
You did not address the SPD or SDP provisions. And so would you clarify that for me?
The reason I did that is because the case law that I looked at and everything that I looked at, my first argument that the client does not reach the level of SPP or an SDP is, of course, the harmful sexual conduct. So in order to get in the door with the harmful sexual conduct, you have to have a course of sexual behavior. His course of sexual behavior was 10 years ago. That was where he committed his statutory definition of harmful sexual.
Well, do you think him masturbating in front of female guards is part of his sexual behavior?
So here's a young man who's 17 to 27. He's in prison. And what he said in his testimony was that it was always at night, and they had to use a flashlight to see it. And it was 5 times in 10 years that he was cited for it. And the last time,
including one time after he knows that the county is petitioning for him to be civilly committed.
And the judge did mention that in his findings. But if you go to the exhibit, in the exhibit, it states.
In which exhibit are we talking about? The one you were referencing, Addendum 32?
It's the exhibit where the. If I may have a moment to look at my. I do cite it in my brief that. All masturbation. It was Exhibit 18, and which is a copy of the September 21st violation of 2021, which read that the guard who wrote the report said, "I do not believe this is to be targeted behavior for his masturbation," which would indicate that he wasn't doing it for gratification or not, well, I take that back, to draw attention from a female guard. That's what I assumed why it's written that way. So to me, the reason, to go back to your original question, is if he doesn't get in, because I felt the strongest argument that I have in the case is that he has not committed a sex offense. He was a juvenile when he committed the sex offenses. And that is how harmful sexual conduct is described in the statute, are these crimes. Masturbation is not fall within the purview of the harmful sexual conduct, and he was not criminally charged for it. He was cited for it in the records, but he said he was told in his testimony, he said he was told about, he didn't know about the rules to start with, that you had to have a sheet over yourself, and so after that he followed the rules. That's his testimony. So I would argue that his masturbation practices do not fall within the purview of the Harmful Sexual Conduct Act, and that there is not a course of harmful sexual conduct here.
And I think Dr. Lindemann agreed with that. I think Dr. Lindemann agreed with that in her analysis.
Yeah, she found that he didn't meet the SPP, but he met the SDP. And it was, I mean, they all of the findings are really based, though, heavily on his history of his sexual behavior during the time of his offenses. That's what they base everything on.
Well, and the lack of engagement with any kind of programming designed to address the underlying sexual misconduct, correct? I mean, we can't forget about that.
Well, the problem with that, Your Honor, is that he was willing to go to treatment. But once again, I'm going to refer back to his youthfulness when he was offered the treatment. And he was willing to go to treatment, but because if you don't own up to your the allegations as in the complaint, they don't allow you to go to treatment at the DOC.
So would Pastor Milton allow him to do treatment without admitting his misconduct?
He has to go to treatment in the community. And I'm sure there's, well, we did not address that in the Dawn Block or the ISR agent. She testified that she would find a program for him. There's a number of programs. She did say that. And she looked specifically to the need of the client.
But doesn't the statute require the committed person or the person who is subject to the commitment petition to bring forth evidence of a program that is willing to accept that person at that time? And was there any such evidence presented to the district court here?
Well, she didn't look for any program because that is a big problem in all these cases. If they are sitting in a maximum secure facility and they don't know if they're going to get out and these programs are hard to get into, then they don't put a lot of effort into getting. But I found Pastor Mary Milton, who is totally willing, culturally specific programming for Mr. Renfro. She does transformation, and although she doesn't have explicit training with, you know, the type of statistics at Dr. Lindemann and Dr. The examiners have, she still has had a lot of treatment with or transformation with her clients. And she's willing to take him. And he is mandated to complete treatment. That's That's the thing here. He's mandated to complete treatment. If he doesn't go to treatment, he's going to get sent back to the DOC. He's got lifetime supervision. He's going to be on a GPS. He's going to have the ISR agent 24/7. I mean, that she's responsible for him. And he has to comply with all these conditions. There is a less restrictive alternative here. And he's got the support of his family, and he's got Transformation Ministries. So that being said, I would ask you to find that there's a least restrictive alternative. And I'll save my last 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel. Yes, you will have that 5 minutes. Counsel for respondent?
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Wald, and I represent respondent Ramsey County in this appeal. I don't have a whole lot to add besides what's already written in my brief, but I did just want to respond to a couple of the court's questions that were already made to appellant's counsel. And first, I just wanted to turn to issue number two, which is the less restrictive treatment program, which, of course, we only get to that issue if a finding of SPP or SDP was made, which the court here, Judge Mulrooney, did find. And so then it turns to appellant. In this case, it's his burden to offer a less restrictive treatment program. And I'm quoting from Minnesota Statute 253D.07 Subdivision 3, that it's a less restrictive treatment program. And state's position is that that appellant failed to meet his burden here because he did not put forth any treatment program that was available.
But why isn't the Transformational Ministry program, why doesn't that qualify as a treatment program? Is there some statutory definition it doesn't meet? Or why couldn't we conclude that that is a treatment program?
I didn't brief specifically. At the district court, the chief argument was that the treatment program that's available is intensive supervised release. And intensive supervised release is not a treatment program. It's a condition of being released from prison. Now, there might be terms of probation that involve treatment, but there was no specific treatment that had accepted appellant. There was also testimony regarding Transformation Ministry, and the state's position would be that does not meet the threshold of what the statute is really contemplating when it's talking about treatment, whether that's mental health treatment, sexual offense treatment, from a provider that would have the qualifications here. And there was a question as to Pastor Milton's qualifications or the other people providing the kind of the care or the in Transformation Ministry. And I'm no discredit to the program and what it's trying to do, but Pastor Milton herself, said that she has taken some classes and she's worked in this field for a while, but she's not qualified to provide treatment, the sort of treatment that I think the statute is contemplating, whether that's mental health or sex offense treatment. But regardless, even if this court were to decide, there is evidence that a treatment program is available, namely Transformation Ministries. Still, Judge Mulrooney's findings that treatment program does not serve public safety and will not meet appellant's needs at this time was not clearly erroneous. That was not an abuse of discretion. The record is overwhelming that appellant has not started sex offense treatment, much less completed it. He's an untreated sex offender at this time. There's no evidence that there is a sex offense treatment program other than an indeterminate commitment that has accepted appellant and that will meet his needs as a sexual offender. In addition,
agent did talk about Alpha Services. Why isn't that a sex offender treatment program that's appropriate for him?
There was testimony from Ms. Block that there is no dispute that there's treatment in the community, but the testimony of Ms. Block is that, especially in terms of inpatient treatment, that there's only a couple of programs that they're extremely difficult to get into, and there's long wait lists. And so the state's position would be, if appellant is going to step down from a custodial supervision, that he ought to go to in-person treatment. And the only testimony in the record is that there's a long wait list and no guarantee that he's going to get into that. So let's say he would go something less than inpatient treatment for sex offense, that an outpatient treatment, which there would not meet his needs or meet public safety's needs. Still, there's no evidence in the record that he could start, you know, the day that he's released or soon after. There's just no evidence. So the Judge Mulrooney's findings that there's no less restrictive treatment alternative was not clearly erroneous, and I'd ask the court to uphold that finding.
Let's go back to the first question. As you said in the beginning of your argument, we only get to less restrictive alternative if we were to affirm the district court's determination that the criteria for commitment were met. And, you know, I am struck here by the appellant's age and the fact that he offended sexually, and I think his lawyer concedes that the three sex offenses committed within less than a year would qualify as a course of harmful sexual conduct, but that was 10 years ago. How do you respond to the argument that that can't be a course, even coupled with his masturbation while in custody over the 10-year period, that that's just not enough under all these circumstances to satisfy the statutory requirement of a course?
Well, first I'd respond that I cite numerous cases that say there's no threshold. You know, one sex offense is probably not going to be a course, but there's case law saying that two is sufficient for a course. And I cite many cases that three is sufficient. So even if you discredit...
Many of these are over a longer period of time, and you always sort of wonder, well, what has this person done in between being caught or charged or whatever? But here we don't have any... Because he hasn't been in treatment, there's no disclosure of other things. And again, this is such a compressed period of time, 10 years ago. Are there any cases that are close to those set of facts?
I'd have to look again at the cases that I cite and to see if there's any that specifically have the window here. We have about a year period of three very serious, quite violent sexual offenses, and then a term of incarceration for approximately 9 years. And what I would say in response is, first, after those three offenses, he was incarcerated, and he's been incarcerated. And so his opportunity to offend sexually in the manner that he was offending has not been present to him. He hasn't had young females to offend sexually against in prison, except for the masturbation incidents. And we can talk about those separate in a moment. So the fact that there's been this gap, there is case law saying that, look, you can look back a long period of time, and the fact that he has been incarcerated, and so that there's a gap between when he committed these offenses and the present time, that's no indication that he's cured or wouldn't pose a danger. It's just simply the fact that he's been incarcerated. Secondly, I'd note that this isn't, we may very well be sitting at a different place here if appellant had committed these offenses, gone to prison, and done sex offense treatment and completed it, or at least started it and shown some progress. But the fact is, as soon as he entered prison, I don't know if the record says as soon, but when he was given the opportunity, when they looked at doing sex offense treatment, he claimed no responsibility. And so he has never had any sex offense treatment. And so that's what's unique about this case is here we have three violent sexual offenses, a period of incarceration, and then no treatment. So I think that's what makes this case unique. The state does argue that those six masturbation incidents are and should be considered part of the course of harmful sexual conduct. And Judge Mulrooney so found, and that was not clear error. I cite at least three cases. Granted, I think they're all non-precedential decisions from this court, but all three of those cases rely on both sex offenses in the community and then masturbation incidents within a custodial setting as part of the course of harmful sexual conduct. And I would just note a couple of important facts about those masturbation incidents. First, all of those incidents involved female officers. So that shows a certain willfulness on the part of appellant here, that he's specifically doing, engaging in this behavior in, or in this manner when it's female officers. And specifically, in one of those incidents, he was noted to have been calling out the correctional officer's name, saying something to the effect of, I love you, and then soon after he was caught doing this. So it shows it's not just, okay, he's relieving his needs, but there is, and this was noted by both examiners and found by Judge Mulrooney, that look, these aren't just innocuous instances meeting his needs, but of further sexually offending in really the only way that he had available to him in prison. So the state's position would be, look, we're talking about 9 sexual offenses over a period of 9 or 10 years. The last one in 2021, while he was facing a possible civil commitment petition. But even if you don't look at the masturbation incident, still the 3 violent sexual offenses in the community, followed by a term of incarceration and no sexual offense treatment in the interim, is sufficient for a finding of harmful sexual conduct or a habitual course of harmful sexual conduct. And for that, if there are no further questions from the panel, I don't see any, I would simply ask that this court affirm Judge Mulrooney's findings and his order indeterminately committing appellant. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hewitt, you have 5 minutes for rebuttals.
I would once again ask you to take into consideration the appellant's young age. He was 17 years old, a high school student, a junior in high school, when he had these 3 sexual offenses.
But he was certified as an adult. He was treated as an adult, right?
I'm sorry.
He was certified as an adult for these offenses?
He was certified as an adult. But that doesn't take away the fact where he was in his life. He was a junior in high school. And in the transcript, you will see Mama called him baby. He was a baby. So he was a young 17-year-old, and he was offered treatment. He accepted the treatment. It was a treatment program that would not let him in. And so and the 5 masturbation, if you look at the record, through that DOC record, if you go to every one of them, which I have done, those masturbation incidents were over a 10-year period. He's 17 to 27, and it does appear that they are female guards, but it does not, the incident where he was calling out is not correlated with the masturbation. If you go through the record, the DOC record, that is an error. That's in the DOC record. So I would ask you not to find that he has a course of harmful sexual conduct. He did it when he was 17 years old. He was a high school junior, and he had never been incarcerated prior to that incident. He had some truancy. He had an incident where a girl was at his house, but he had never been incarcerated. He had no heavy crimes that he had committed prior to these assaults. My last thing is, he can get in a program as soon as he would be released into Transformation Ministries. What is treatment but transformation? Treatment is all about transformation. It's about a change. It's about changing a behavior. That is a start. And it's culturally specific to him. He is a young black man who can go to a culturally specific program. And she said in her transcript, in her testimony, that she has dealt with men like Malcolm, or like the appellant. So there is a treatment available. And secondly, the Department of Corrections, whether there is a program that's available right away, they have to find a treatment program for Mr. Renfro. They are obligated by their conditional release there for him to go to a program. So he will not only have culturally specific programming, he will have Department of Corrections sex offender program.
What also, evidence supports a finding that the Transformation Ministry program would be consistent with the requirements of public safety?
Well, the public safety issue, Don Block, the ISR agent, talked about that. And she said it is the most intensive form of supervision.
That's the intensive supervision. I'm asking about the treatment program through the Transformation Ministry.
The Transformation Ministries, it's not like a locked unit. And that may not be what the ISR agent would recommend anyway. So if you're looking into public safety, you have to look at the big picture and say he's going to be under the Department of Corrections ISR with a GPS on him, and they can extend ISR for as long as they need to. So public safety will be addressed. And his father testified at the hearing that he is going to be scrutinizing his son's behavior, and he wants to make sure he never ends up back where he is today. I would ask that you look closely at the culturally specific programming that is available to Mr. Renfro and see it as a less restrictive alternative, because he also has the DOC programming that he's going to be mandated to go to. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period.